If you're curious while I'm talking about the story behind the story, my book, Judge, is actually free everywhere right now. Apple, Kobo, Nook, Google Play, Amazon, all of them, so you can read along. Hi, and welcome to the Politics of Justice. It's me, Amy Austin. Yeah. So first I'll say this. I just finished this sweater. It's called The Typical Boyfriend Henley. I'll include a link to the pattern on Ravelry. I like to knit. I like to knit sweaters. It is 70 degrees outside in Los Angeles in December. But here we go. So back to the politics of justice. I'm talking about the book Judged, which is not in the background because I just switched it for something else yesterday. And I want to talk a little bit about chapter four. The iPad has a lot of flashing messages. I want to talk about chapter four called The Burbs. I was just rereading it before I started recording. And of course it brought back like a cascade of memories, not only of writing the book 9,000 years ago, but also the inspiration, because like the more I read about it, a lot of the things that happened to Olivia Grant in the book also happened to me. So in chapter four, so Olivia's talking. She's the point of view character in this chapter. And we learn a lot about her new life in Shaker Heights. Previously, she lived in, now I remember, the Glenville neighborhood of Cleveland, which is, or was, I don't know actually anything about Cleveland anymore, a predominantly Black community in Cleveland, which actually has a large Black population as a city, as opposed to like Los Angeles, which does not. And so she has left this Glenville neighborhood. Her mom's divorced, but they'd say they're subsequent to the divorce. And now they're in Shaker Heights. My best recollection, and you know, I guess I'll find out later, is that Sheila Harrison Grant was really interested in upgrading her life. She sort of came from, I don't want to say a hard scrabble background, it's not really that, but working class parents. She went to college, she went to law school. Now she has been appointed as a recess federal judge, which is a job, oh my God, when Congress or the Senate is on recess, they can appoint people who can be confirmed in the next session. It is a way that many, at least previous to, well, a long time ago in the civil rights era, when many judges and justices were appointed, because once you have the job, it's hard to fire people from the job without looking pretty awful, because then you can't say they're not qualified. So it was a way to appoint a lot of Black judges and justices, like Thurgood Marshall, et cetera. Who was the first Black Supreme Court justice in the U.S. So we start with Olivia. It's October of 2020. I'm sorry. I put my bracelets back on. I got them refurbished. I don't know, cleaned and whatever. You can send them away and get it cleaned. And now I'm wearing them again. They are noisy. But taking them off is pretty impossible, as I've learned in airports in France, where they always want me to take off things. So Olivia is sort of in geography class and sort of taking in this new environment. And so as I had said in the previous video, when I was 10 or 11, I believe I turned 10. I have to think about it like more than a second, and I don't want to think about it. I moved to a mostly white suburb in Connecticut. And Shaker Heights is not similar, but her experiences, because it's what I experienced and I could write about comfortably for my absolute first book that I wrote, she is sort of having that experience of not really fitting in. So she's sitting in geography class. I'm going to publish an essay about this. I wrote an essay. It's going to be published in a book sometime soon. Who knows, publishers, you know, where I actually talk about this, because one of my catalysts for travel was my inability to do well in geography at school. It's pretty horrible, my geography knowledge. So she's sitting in geography doodling, because she don't care much about geography either. And she's thinking about how the students, like the white students at the school, are very friendly on the surface, but she can't or is not accessing those deeper relationships that she thinks she should have. And there is a lot of, I think in books, like kids' books, YA books, and as well as like on TV in the 80s, there was like this huge sense that like girls had best friends, girls had a girl gang, and I had no access to that. Well, I had friends, I didn't have a girl gang, or maybe I could have joined it, but like it was, I had a lot of politics about the girl gang. And so she's sort of lamenting that she doesn't have that. Then she's also like integrating into this new school and dealing with school professionals who have their own personal opinions about her. And those two things are crashing, as well as like attending school, like the main thing your children are supposed to be doing. So she like loses this, this is so up my alley. So her teacher, she's doodling and daydreaming. She did not think about geography. And the teacher calls on her and asks her what the five major rivers are in Russia. And the only river she knows is the Volga. I'm going to tell you now, maybe there are five major rivers in Russia. I don't know, but I do know the Volga. I've actually never seen it. And I'm obviously not going to be going to Russia anytime soon. I should have gone, well, 10 years ago. Alas. So many things one should have done 10 years ago. So she doesn't know that. So he's going to hold her after class. And he does the thing that has happened to me, oh my God, more times in my life than I would like. Many times, starting when I moved to Connecticut, this actually never happened to me in New York, but like New York was, the schools were so rigid and like nobody, like teachers never talked to me. They got up, did their lecture, and you took your tests and moved right along. Except for me talking too much. I didn't get in trouble much in school, but I did talk too much. And I was always like, I was always in trouble for it. Always. But what are you going to do? So the gift of the gab. So he pulls her aside after class and does the whole like, this has been done to me so many times. He does the whole thing where he looks down at her and he's like, well, I know that this may be hard for you. But if you want to be the first person in your family who goes to college, you're going to have to really focus. And this happened to me so many times. And well, okay, I'm not a compliant person. So usually I would be like, okay, so my mother went to college and she went to like an Ivy League graduate school. So where's this conversation going? Which always ended the conversation because they had never expected. I don't know if they didn't expect me to talk back or they didn't expect me to say that. I didn't ask because I was like, mic drop, and I walked out. But it happened to me in middle school, happened to me in high school. When people thought I was acting up or they were going to like reach out and help me, you know, whatever. It's like freaking after school special. But it actually happened to me in college. So I went to Smith and I remember sitting in an orientation. Okay. So back in the era, I don't even know if they do this anymore. They would have these like special, actually they did this in law school. What are you saying? They would have these special orientations for people of color. I went to the Black people orientation. They went for Asian students. I don't know what else they had. I only know about those two. In the 80s, it may have actually been only those two, but I believe they had other affinity orientations that came 2 or 3 days or up to a week before the regular orientation, like for new students. So, oh God, I forgot about the law school one. Anyway, but I went because I always figured like maybe there was something I didn't know and I could, I don't know, the secret special knowledge. And also I didn't want to be at home for this reason. So I remember we're sitting in some like, you know, sitting on the floor cross-legged, who knows, on pillows, you know, talking about your background or whatever. And some well-meaning person pulls me aside and they're like, well, you know, we were just here to like help you and you can reach out because we know that you probably haven't had anybody in your family's gone to college and the whole thing may be unfamiliar to you. And I was like, ready for the mic drop? ready for the mic drop. But it happens so often. I don't even know if it would happen anymore. I wonder if it would happen to my child. Okay, I have to think about that. But just the idea that, like, most people who are in college are there because they have family who are in college. And there's a huge divide in the U.S., to my understanding, that one of the predictors of going to college is that your parents went to college. So I assumed that I was there for the same predictor reasons that other people were there. Apparently nobody else assumed that. I'm sorry, I just wanted to rant. But this happens to her. In this chapter, and I wrote about it because it was such a It happened so often, and people were so often wrong, and it just felt invalidating, I guess, is the word I want to say. So next she meets, this is like her first, who knows, few days, weeks, whatever. She meets a college counselor who I guess has read her file. I don't know how she would know this, but she read her file. And she says, "Oh, your mother's a judge. Would you like to be like a lawyer?" So then Olivia has the other feeling where she says, "I don't want to be anything like my mother." But I will say that that made her feel seen. So at this point, the counselor hands her a little slip of paper and says, "We have a little four, it's four girls only with an exclamation point group. And everything we talk about that is confidential. If you ever want to talk about anything, you can speak to me." Clearly, Olivia does not know the words mandated reporter. But so that sort of like in juxtaposition to this teacher who thinks one way of her, she has a meeting with this counselor who thinks in an entirely different way. And I think makes her vulnerable to what's going to happen later in the book. But so at the end of this chapter, like she's pulled out by the girls. Some of the girls that she had gone to dinner with at Benihana, I believe. And they make another sort of like racial joke, which I guess now would be called a microaggression, but I didn't know, we didn't have those terms when I was younger. But people would always make it was it happened to me actually often. Like I used to wear hats. God, it was the 80s. Forgive me, but I loved a fedora or like any kind of hat. So I always wore a hat in school, and I thought I had great hat head. I actually don't have hats anymore, and I really don't wear them. But she was wearing in this book a scarf, I think. And somebody's like, "Oh, why are you wearing the scarf?" So Olivia's thinking about this whole like thing with her mother, where they got the scarf and acquired it, and how she like figured out to tie it a certain way, and she was thinking that she fit in because she had this cool scarf. And the kids are sort of like, "Oh, well, all the other black kids are wearing scarves. We thought it was that." And there was a lot of that othering. I remember that whenever I would do something, people were like, "Oh, all the black kids wearing hats today," or whatever. So there were black kids in my high school. We had busing. So whatever. There's just that. And so maybe there were in my class of like 100 and some odd kids, maybe 5 or 10. I can't say. I'm so sorry. The Ring doorbell. There's a guy with a package. So that kind of thing happened, and it never felt great because then you didn't feel seen, you felt lumped in, and it wasn't like I was not a joiner. Shocker. So I was always under the impression that I was doing my own thing. And for people to see me as part of a monolithic group without seeing me individually, never felt good. Then there's like some stuff in the chapter about like what does I want to say? Her relationship with her mother, which is like, anyway, it ebbs and flows. Sometimes she feels good, and sometimes it doesn't. But but the only home you have is the only home you have, and she's doing her best to make the best of it. So, back in chapter five, I do have a couple of notes. So, the chapter five is called Juvenile Court. It's Casey Court's first appearance in the series in Juvenile Court in Cuyahoga County. I'm sure, as I explained before, there were two family law courts, divorce. People who were married, or divorced got one court. People who were unmarried got the other court. The court, domestic relations court, may have handled cases better than juvenile court. Anyway, but also it did the abuse, neglect, dependency, as well as like juvenile crimes. And so she's in juvenile court. Juvenile court was like, I don't even know because I don't know if there's another experience like it. Like basically your clients have to sit in this hallway and the hallway is crowded. I mean, these are old buildings, like maybe like late 1800s, early 1900s building. The building had been was a juvenile detention center before that. They don't use it anymore, so I don't know the whole history. I'd have to actually think about it. But so this is an old building. The heat is always like on blast. This is before air conditioning was really like an effective thing everywhere. So it was always crowded, always hot. And so to contrast it, in domestic relations, marble floors and granite walls or vice versa. And it was like walking, I don't even know how to explain it, like There were hardly ever people in the hallways. You could walk and hear your like footsteps echo. It was really dark. It felt very reverent. And juvenile court was exactly the opposite. It felt like you had just walked into like a carnival. They had like food trucks. They weren't food trucks, call that back then, but like food trucks out front where you could buy like snacks or potato chips and a lot of ice cream. I don't know. I never could figure that out. I don't think I ever bought anything from a food truck ever. So it was like this really like carnival atmosphere in one hand, and then like a completely different sort of atmosphere on the other end. And so she's there and they're like calling out names. They're like, Joe, your case is next. Joe, your case is next. I mean, they would really like literally come out in the hallway and scream. And then if you were Joe, you would, go into either the judge's chambers or the magistrate's chambers to have your case heard. There were no court reporters or court reporters in domestic relations court. In juvenile court, they used tape recorders. And as a person who had to get tapes and have them transcribed to do appeals, it was interesting. Tape recorders are not the best because people don't always speak into the microphone. So much was garbled and lost. Whether that's justice, that's on you. So people make fun of her name. Her name is Casey Court. I named her after somebody I went to law school with, whose name I now cannot say, but it was similar. And I just love the name. And if I had done it over again, I should have chosen that as pen name. So she, the note I have in the chapters when I practiced in juvenile court. Oh, sometimes people's comments can be cold, because, and this people said this more often than not. And it always felt. It never felt great. And it wasn't even a microaggression, like, or whatever about me. But often court officers would say, this family is so messed up that I wouldn't allow them to care for my pets, much less kids. And that always felt, I'm not saying everybody is a great parent. Clearly, the book is about that. And I'm not saying that everybody like does the best by their children, but like to relegate them to people that you wouldn't leave pound dogs with always felt, I don't know, it didn't feel good. Anyway, chapter six is called Home Fires, and it is, excuse me, it's a Sheila chapter, that's what I thought. But we're, so these are all the same day. It's all the same day in October. So you get this Olivia in school with like her experience, Casey in juvenile court with her experience, and then we're gonna get Sheila. And I think, as I said earlier, like I really liked the way that Philip Margolin told books with like disparate, weaving together disparate tales. I'm not as good at it, and my tale's not as disparate. Like I have a formula and I kind of stick with it, and it works for me. It's the best I can do. So like the first, so she's like, Sheila is really, really concerned with appearances. She's concerned with her daughter. So she thinks her daughter is chubby. And I know that Olivia's like eating her feelings. I've eaten my feelings. People eat their feelings. And I think I went through a phase where I was like, I think I was a chubby child, not like little. But maybe like there's this horrible, awkward phase. There are pictures between like, I don't know, 9, 10, 11, 12, where I ate my feelings and I got kind of chubby and I had to wear, did they call them husky clothes? I forget what they call the size, where they were just saying you were chubby but not saying anything about it. And I outgrew it by 16 and then, or 15, and then you're dealing with men on the street. And I was wearing mini skirts. Not that that's an excuse. I liked a mini skirt, and it didn't help. So she's watching her daughter eating and having crumbs, which for some reason like really aggravates her. She's watching her daughter like be klutzy, and that really aggravates her. She really like watches her daughter watching TV, and that aggravates her. Like a lot about her daughter aggravates her because it doesn't represent what she thinks her daughter should be, which is some ideal. I don't know. I always call it like the Buffy standard, like where she should be like basically some like thin white person, but her daughter can't be that. So I'm not, it's just, it's incongruent. I'll just leave it there. But her mother offers her, like, offers to order food. And then directs what her daughter can order. And she's like, let's order from like this Italian place. And she's like, you get an Italian salad, which is like a popular thing on the East Coast, which is basically a salad with like pepperoncini, a lot of salami on it. So like salami, cheese, dressing, pepperoni. Actually, no, I miss an Italian salad. I wonder if you can get one. Anyway, but she does it and then picks apart her doing it. Don't have dressing, don't have the pepperoni. And I'm thinking, why would she let her order that? But because she's like drinking, like her excuse, I think, in Sheila's excuse in her head is that like she has a drink to put up with because look at how difficult this daughter is to raise. And I had a mother who was always said I was very difficult to raise. She's also like, Sheila's also dealing with being, honestly, like I'm not saying this is easy, being like the first black partner at a law firm, this judge. And we learn in the book that like getting the judgeship was sort of like pushing her out of the law firm. And there's a lot of that in law firms where they get you a different job, often in-house counsel, to push you out of the firm, but they push you out with a soft fall. Like they don't like just like fire you and leave you on the street. Well, not everybody, some people, but there's a soft fall. It makes everybody look good. It's like completely so much image control. But so she's like leaves Olivia to like her salad or dressing or whatever, cookies or whatever. And she's just sort of in her room, like drinking and like reminiscing about like what it was like being in partnership and a relationship she had with a mentor who's a guy named Peyton Bennett, who pops up in the books and is like literally one of my favorite characters. I don't even think he's probably not even a good person. But I adore him. Sort of like the Lincoln lawyer. Like something about a certain asshole that I love. But she asks a lot about partner. She talks about like the highlight is never ask, never receive, my father always said, which is actually something I believe. You ask, you get it, you don't get it, but you're never worse off than where you started. But something she says, honesty was not the best policy in the legal world. Making a truth that fits a narrative was better. That's true of the law. There's nothing else to say about it. It's just true. But I mean, part of me, like in this chapter, I think what I wanted to do was do like two sort of different things. I wanted to show like how she's not particularly caring or loving to her daughter, even though there's nothing wrong with Olivia. And clearly, you know, from last chapter, Olivia's going through her own crap. But also, I wanted to be a little sympathetic to her because her life is not easy. She's like a divorced black woman. She's a single mom. She's like gotta have a job and then gotta like navigate this world in law firms that is predominantly white and predominantly male and kind of hasn't changed. And you know, like every firm may have like a black person or a black woman, but like navigating it as a token and trying to get ahead and trying to convince people that she's capable of doing the work is difficult. It's not an excuse for drinking. It's not an excuse for how she treats her child. But I did want to acknowledge that, like, that's like a difficult thing. Anyway, chapter 7, progress report. This is like a week later, and it's Olivia. And I was actually thinking about this, not this particular thing, but I was thinking about it in the car. I was listening to a podcast, probably The Honeydew, which is like my favorite podcast. And whoever Ryan Sickler was interviewing was discussing how was discussing with them like the guy was saying something. He was like his was having the guest was having a conversation with his father, and his father starts by saying something, and he thought his father was going to say, "We got your grades," but I think his father said like, "Your mom's dying" or something, because it's that kind of podcast. I love a tragedy, but it reminded me of like that feeling I would get. So this is well before computers. You couldn't log into your kid's progress report daily at school. And before all of that, you would log in. I mean, they would log in. I'm sorry, your progress report would come in the mail. So when I was in school, I believe we're in semesters. So you'd get like halfway through the first semester and you get a progress report that would, I guess, give your grade up to the moment. That's my guess, best guess, or best memory, I guess, in my memory. And when I moved, so I went from like living in New York and having straight A's, except I got an F in religion. I did fail religion, but I figured that would not affect my life. Not so good at that. And The like, but when I moved to Connecticut, my grades were worse. I think, to be honest, I was sort of rebelling. I was like, I'm not doing this. I'm not doing this. I'm not singing and not dancing the dance because there was so much pressure and so much talked about, like, you're the straight A student, you're a straight A student, you're a straight A student. And I was over it. I was over the pressure of trying to maintain being a straight A student throughout my life. So, and clearly I didn't study the five rivers, if there's five in Russia. And so I like always lived in dread of the progress report, because let me tell you, those I heard this later, like, and I may have written about it later in some book, but some teacher was talking to another teacher in the hall, and I heard them. They were discussing the B minus girls, and they were girls because we didn't have pluses and minuses. So as long as you got like an 81, you can get a B. It was no different than getting an 89. So I knew that you could float that line. So, but getting Bs in my life was not acceptable. So she's like, she gets jolted awake in her morning, by her mother, who says, like, she jolted me awake and like starts screaming at her about the report and how her mother's, I'm doing all this for you and you're like not, you know, grateful, yada yada. And that's something that I remember happening all too often. I don't know what this is about people waking you up, but my mother would wake me up to yell at me and then drive me to school instead of taking the school bus. So then I'm like the crying, sniveling mess, and which is a way to start your school day. But I remember it happening and I didn't enjoy it. I don't even know it. So the highlight is, oh, my mother used to yank the covers off her. Yeah, my mom used to do that. It'll get you off, I'll tell you that. So like Olivia's clearly not thrilled with this. So she's Olivia says, I ran to the bathroom, and even though I tried hard to hold it together, my eyes smarted and my nose dripped. Thank God my mother didn't see. There was little room for emotion in my mother's house. That's true. And the post-it note that I posted says Olivia's growing up in a household where her mother's the only person who feels like she has the right to emotion. And I remember that. Actually, it's so funny. So, okay, so there's a an IG post today from Noelle Stark, this author, and she's asking about the top five books. And so I sent her my books, and I'll link to it in the show in the notes. But the books I read this year were all about, well, women's labor and the thing that makes me angry, and social media, both fiction and nonfiction. Last year, I was obsessed with, I have to cut it because I don't remember, I just lost my train of thought. Last year, I was obsessed with. I read a book about reality television, and I don't know what planet I'm on, but I hadn't realized that there were A, so many reality TV shows. I just didn't know. Like, I read the whole book about reality shows, and I like literally had only heard of like two of the shows. One was like The Bachelor, the other one was the one the president was on, which I thought there was only one season, and like Survivor. Like, I saw one season of Survivor, I saw the first season of The Bachelor. And I saw the first season of whatever the You're Fired show with Omarosa. And that's it. And in my head, like, reality shows had gone away because I stopped watching them. Because I was like, yeah, this is not for me. I also didn't have cable. While I was paying off loans, I got rid of cable. Then I got into the habit of not having cable. And then it went away. We were streaming. So I, in 2024, was obsessed with reality shows. So I've decided to start watching them, mainly because I'm writing books. And it's really hard for me. I realize like I'm somewhat divorced from popular culture, but I only watch, which I now know, well, there's a thousand reality shows. The only ones I watch are dating romance reality shows. So Love is Blind, Married at First Sight, and some other one that I've can't remember. Pretty bad at it. But this season's Married at First Sight on Peacock, I watched last month or a few weeks ago. And there's this person named Rhonda on the show. This season, I guess, is the first one where they have older couples. She's 60 something, let's say 62, 63 in the show. Rhonda is the only person in her orbit who is allowed to like have emotion. She's married to this guy named Pat, like, no, to Pat's detriment, in like when he met her, he did go on in the way that sometimes men go on, where you get the sense that they don't want to know you. And so he does go on, and she corrects him the first time. She was like, I just told you like my house is robbed, and you're like going on about, I think he's a new pilot or something, flying and the weather, I don't know. He does go on. I mean, they do like a montage where they just keep cutting and cutting and cutting. And he's just talking and talking and talking. And they make it appear like he's talking for hours. Who knows? You know, editing. But after that, she has the worst edit. It appears that she's the only person in the room whose ability to have an emotion. And whenever she says something and her husband doesn't respond in the right way, she's like, hey, hey, you know? And like, no matter what, she turns it around, and if he like so much as like pauses and doesn't like, can't like repeat back what she said or how she felt, he's in the wrong. And like, that reminded me so much of this and so much of like my own childhood, where like, nobody's interested, at least my mother wasn't interested in anything I felt, but she was, if I so much as like didn't like catch her emotion, I was in the wrong. And that's really hard. And so Olivia's not really able to talk to her mother that she's really struggling. Like, she's struggling with this new move. And I think a different child in a different household, I don't know if they would have thrived. I mean, let's not say all that, but would have done better, or would have had a better sense of self, or would have had a bit greater confidence or greater way to navigate this. I mean, clearly your mother's navigating a similar dynamic where she's like the only Black person or the smart Black person or whatever. And like, so she could have shared like ways to navigate that, but instead there's just merely like criticism. Chapter 8, there may be no notes. I don't know. I'm going to look. Hold on. It's a long book. Chapter 8, Clients Don't Pay. It's just Casey talking about, I think clients don't pay. She jams her car into the ATM. It doesn't come back. Her best friend, Lulu, who is the character in His Lost Mistress. I love Lulu. Lulu's Casey's best friend. Lulu makes some not great choices in that book. But what are you going to do? Lulu has her own family issues. Much more privilege, much more money, still family issues. But, you know, so Casey's like out at this restaurant. Oh, I used to love this place. What was it called? Something. It was like a breakfast restaurant at Shaker Square in Cleveland. I can't remember the name of it. Oh, but they have a breakfast called the Killet Skillet, and they had a thing that, can you skillet? It comes with eggs, hash browns, bacon, sausage, all covered in melted cheese, and a little mini loaf of ciabatta bread. I didn't need to kill that skillet. but I did. Only maybe once. I ordered different things later. But she talks a lot about Casey. You get to know Casey a little bit, like, through this conversation with her best friend about not having money, about having these kinds of cases. The reason that she has, like, she's working as a solo practitioner and not in a law firm. She had a run-in with some rich people, which is dealt with, I think, in the book, Disgraced. But Casey's having a hard go of it for completely different, well, money reasons. And being a solo practitioner, it's hard to make money. There's a lot of lawyers. I actually meet them every so often now, and they have to hustle so much for clients, and you have to get so much money up front, but you often know getting money up front that your client's not going to pay you on the back end. Debt from lawyers is not a write-off. So the personal services are not a write-off. I don't know, it's IRS rule. So if your client doesn't pay, your client just doesn't pay, and you just have to suck it up. Anyway, chapter 9 is called Blackout, and this is like another Sheila Harrison Grant chapter, where she's drinking and sort of like rehashing. There's a lot of flashbacks, and my writing got better, but she's rehashing, like, she feels aggrieved. She's a whole martyrdom aggrieved thing, and she feels aggrieved because the husband she married is not the husband that she hoped to have. She wanted somebody with greater ambition, greater drive, somebody who could like match her energy, and she married a guy from the neighborhood and didn't get that. The highlight says it wasn't the divorce that was the mistake, it was the marriage. But she's still aggrieved about it. So she talks about that. Then she's like re sort of hashing her marriage, her divorce. Like she spends a lot of time, like this is like, well, she's drinking because of work. She's drinking because raising a kid is hard. She's drinking because she's still aggrieved about her marriage. Now, I have thoughts, addiction, and drinking, and I don't think they're excuses, but I try to give the reader, make the reader somewhat sympathetic to understanding all the things that Sheila feels that she's dealing with that make her life difficult and maybe make her unavailable to her daughter. Oh my God, chapter 10. Oh, maybe I do this. So this chapter is Alison Feingold, who's the counselor. And she calls the hotline, which, well, I probably shouldn't give the number because the number's still real. She calls the hotline in Cuyahoga County and reports that she thinks that Olivia's mother has an alcohol problem. I don't know. Oh, she. I don't think I skipped a chapter. There's at some point in the book, Olivia goes to the four girls only group, and emboldened by like Allison talking about how there's confidentiality and you can talk to like the girls and you can put anything. She has like a little hat, and each girl can like put on a little slip of paper, talking about things. And I think Olivia puts in a slip of paper about her grades, but I think she also puts in a slip of paper about, what if your mom drinks too much? So Allison does have some discretion. So she picks up the slips of paper and she decides what the group is going to talk about, because some things are probably just inappropriate for middle school girls and wouldn't be confidential, whatever. So creating this aura of confidentiality, there are some like guardrails. And I believe Olivia puts in there that she thinks her mom drinks too much. So this video has probably been long enough. So I'm going to stop here before chapter 11. So we went through way more chapters than before. But there are fewer notes in here. I just wanted to give you some background on it. And it's been interesting rereading a book I wrote a billion years ago. I don't know if it's good or bad. Like it reminds me of like the first it reminds me of that like early feeling like I can write a book. It reminds me that your first book is far too autobiographical. It reminds me of all the influences that I had that I tried to incorporate in this book before I think I had my own style. Like, so I love comedians, and comedians often talk about this, like how they, before they find their voice, they imitate other people. The people they seem to imitate are like George Carlin, Mitch Hedberg, just like various comedians that like come up over and over and over again, Richard Pryor, et cetera, Eddie Murphy, who they imitate. And oh my God, are they all dead? Oh God, they're all dead. Anyway, who they imitate before they like have their own style. And clearly, like, this is like so Philip Margolin coded. I can just see it because I read so many of those books. And I just see myself trying to like imitate that style while telling my own story. And it's interesting because later, like when I write books now, I know that I have like the Amy Austin style, whatever that is. But when reading books and writing books, I know that they're very similar, because I have a certain way that I want to tell the story and I don't stray away from it. But in the beginning, I can see me like trying to stretch my wings and achieve like a style that I thought was really good at storytelling. Whether it's good or not, I don't know. But I will say again, The Judged is free on all platforms. Ebook is free. The audiobook is not free, and paper's not free. Paper's expensive, definitely not free. But the ebook is available everywhere for free. You should download, you can read, you can follow along. If you like this video, please like, subscribe, share. You can even use hype points. I don't don't have high points available to me. I think because my accounts from Reason are still like hungry, listed in Hungary, which where clearly high points are not available. But if you have high points, feel free to use them. It was great talking to you. I'll be back with the next installment of Politics of Justice very soon.